We have to either commit to figuring this out, spending all night, or start the episode. Those are our choices. Well, gentle listener, we've given up trying to figure this out, and we're instead going to come to you and talk about a book. Not about scotch, but about a book. Because this is the podcast, Michael and Ethan in a Room with Scotch. I'm your host, Michael Lilienthal, and this is my guest, Ethan Bartlett.
I'm Michael's guest, Ethan Bartlett, and I'm now actively trying to decide whether I'm going to include any context for how Michael started the show, or literally just start it with him saying what he just said.
See, this is a fun game I like to play, where I like to leave it up to you, the context, and you can take it or leave it, and it might, on the surface of it, make me look foolish, but ultimately we know who the real fool is. Is it the fool, or is it the fool who edits him?
Yeah, I was afraid that's exactly the phrase you were going to say, and you fulfilled all of my worst fears, as usual. I think that you've always had an element of that. I can only feel like it's been strengthened by sort of our last set of records previous to Louise Erdrich's The Sentence, when we did Salem's Lot with Aaron and Risha, and Aaron would just sort of decide in the middle of a conversation, sometimes in the middle of a sentence, to start the podcast for us.
It's true.
Like, I can only assume that she was greatly inspiring to you, as she was greatly inspiring to many people in many ways.
Always is greatly inspiring to many people in many ways, yes.
Anyway, check out Vampires and Mermaids on the Tapestry Radio Network.
Yes, listen to them. They've got some great stuff.
As of when we're recording this, I think episode 8 is out.
I think so.
I haven't listened to any of them. No one tell Aaron or Risha.
I'm going to tell Aaron immediately. I'm texting her as we speak.
I don't like that. I need you to keep hosting the podcast so you forget to text
her. That's right. I need to host this podcast that we're doing and not text other people on the sly, because I can't do that. I'm actually hosting the podcast. So, gentle listener, we're drinking some scotch on this podcast. We are drinking Jura 12. And while we pour this lovely 12-year single malt scotch whiskey, Ethan, would you get your wife in here to read us the rules?
Wife, can you get in here and read us the rules? Michael phrased it that way. It's not my fault.
Rule 1. Once the scotch is poured and the glasses clink, the scotch must not be mentioned at any time. If anyone mentions it, they lose. Rule 2. No one's mother should be mentioned in any pejorative sense or any other sense not directly indicated by the text of the book being discussed. If any mothers are mentioned, the mentioner loses. Rule 3. Ethan must never say the phrase, first paragraph. If he does, he loses. Rule 4. Michael must never say the words, vampire, vampiric, or any derivative thereof. If he does, he loses. Rule 5. If anyone has to use the bathroom during an episode, he or she loses. However, this should not stop anyone from doing so, because this podcast is anti-UTI. Rule number 6. The wives are entitled to one glass of scotch or some equivalent beverage. Rule number 7. If 4 scotch-centric episodes pass with no losses, then everyone loses.
And what happens if someone breaks the rules?
If one person breaks a rule, they receive a punishment in the form of a verbal stunt chosen by the person who did not break the rule. All that being said, everyone, drink responsibly.
Yeah, Ethan.
Yeah, Michael.
Gentle listener.
Thank you, dear.
And with that, l'chaim, or should I say, l'ruach. Ooh, what does that mean?
Sláinte.
It means to a spirit, or to the ghost.
Dang. I mean, that's probably the most of either of us have prepped for this show in ages, is you coming up with that new toast, like, bespoke for this book.
It's not a real toast, just to be clear. And I don't want anybody thinking that it's a real thing, or that I mistakenly thought it was a real thing, because it's not.
But it is like a real word for ghost.
It is, yes.
Yeah, so I'm still counting it as a bespoke toast that you came up with. And I'm
very good.
Definitely still counting it as the most work either of us have done for this podcast in ages.
Well, wait until next episode. But we're talking about this episode. And this episode, we're talking about the book, The Sentence, by Louise Erdrich. We talked a fair amount about ghosts last time, Ethan, but I do want to start off, just right off the bat, by asking you, what makes this a ghost story?
Well, there's a ghost in it.
There's a ghost in it, but does that make it a ghost story?
Well, it's a story what has a ghost in? So yeah. I would say...
But is it a story that has a ghost in it, or is it a ghost story?
Well, it's a ghost story because a ghost story is just a story with the adjective ghost modifying it to indicate the inclusion of a ghost.
But does the adjective ghost, which we can debate that later, actually indicate simply the inclusion of a ghost, or does it mean something more?
I don't know.
Okay, that's fair.
At some point I realized I wasn't giving you... Wait, it was right at the beginning that I realized I wasn't giving you what you wanted from this line of questioning, and I did decide to lean into that instead of cooperating.
Definitely.
And that's your fault.
Is it? Is it my fault?
It's not, but I'm not going to admit that.
Well, I want to touch on something here. It's on, it's not, it doesn't actually have a page number on it. It is page 171. Because this is the heading to a new section. Let Me In is the title of this section.
Mm.
And I suspect, although I didn't actually find anything directly in the text for it, but I suspect that this is a reference. And Ethan, do you know what it is a reference to?
No, Michael, actually, I see what you're trying to do here.
Do you see what I'm trying to do?
You're trying to use my need to be the smartest boy who understands all the references to get me to say a thing that you want to be said, but you're not allowed to say. How am I doing?
You're doing great, Ethan. You're doing wonderful. And I don't like the hostile tone that this podcast has taken all of a sudden.
Why do you say all of a sudden? Because, like, to me, this has just been the last 7 years.
But if I say all of a sudden, it makes me sound more like a victim in the moment.
Yeah, and it makes me sound like the bad guy.
Exactly. So Let Me In would refer to a horror story film. A specific genre, not a ghost story.
I actually believe it was a novel first, which normally...
It was. I'm not familiar for certain of a novel, but I know that the American version is called Let Me In, versus I think it's a Scandinavian film called Let the Right One In.
Yes. So originally it was a novel called Let the Right One In.
There we are.
2004. To put Michael and also the gentle listener out of all of y'all's misery, this is a vampire novel, in case anyone had not guessed that. So yeah, Let the Right One In came out in 2004. It is Scandinavian. Yeah, it was made into a Scandinavian vampire film of the same name, and yeah, you're right, Michael, that the American film version came out after the Scandinavian one was just called Let Me In. I only wanted to be that pedantic about it because, like, it feels like the novel connection should be highlighted just in the context of this book, but...
Right. Well, this whole section, it's a really short section, actually, of the sentence. Just over 20 pages altogether.
Yeah.
And I think other sections are longer, on average than that. The next one might actually be shorter than this. But anyway, it does largely concern itself with the idea of sharing books and the need for books. The connection with another customer who the narrator calls Dissatisfaction. Is brought up, and that's not his actual name. We learn his actual name later, and I actually forget what his name is later. But she calls him Dissatisfaction because he's very choosy about his books, very judgmental when certain novels are recommended to him, and is hard to please. And so there's a list on page 186 of short perfect novels.
Yes.
That is a collaboration between Dissatisfaction and Tookie. It's just delightful. I love lists like this, and we can talk more about the end of this book as well. But the idea that the novels are really kind of the right ones that you want to let in are key here, I think. Mm-hmm. Did you see more of the themes of let the right one in or let me in? I don't know if you've seen either version or anything.
Ages ago, I saw the Scandinavian version.
Sure.
And then when the American version came out, I was at just the right age to be like, well, I've seen the real original one. I'm not going to see this trash. And in the time since I've grown out of that kind of default attitude, I just happen to not have seen it.
Sure.
I will say, like, one thing that was striking me as I was paging through this section as you were highlighting it, just like, if you're tracking some of the vampiric connotations, in terms of what we talked about last episode, this book being a COVID novel, whatever that means or will mean. The first section heading in this book is February 2020. And again, as we talked about last episode, to all of us sort of in the know, which is at the time this book was published in 2021, as well as now in 2024, that is all of us. That's the whole English reading audience that could potentially read this book as of this time, knows what February 2020 signifies.
Yep.
And then as I'm paging through it, in fact, the next section header is March 14th, which... Again, those of us in America, and especially the upper Midwest, that's, like, even more ominous.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the sentence that ends the previous section right before March 14th says the last clause is death was in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, like, yeah.
And then at some point, I thought it was after that March 14th heading, there's, like, a March 8th. It just begins a paragraph. So it's, you know, this whole section is redolent, and then of course, as we go on, it's becoming more and more clear, Louise, towards the end of the section, Louise calls Tookie and, tries to convince her that, getting essential worker status is something to be, like, both, like, gloated about. Is gloated is the word that Louise is described as,
mm-hmm.
What describes her her tone or whatever. You know, it means books are essential, Tookie, Louise says, and Tookie says, I guess. Right. And then Tookie says, she hung up on me. I know that this meant something huge to her, but to me it just meant more uncertainty and jiggered together adaptations. Which, I mean, just as a side note, like, you mentioned last episode that Louise is a character in this novel, and she does kind of the same thing that, like, Dexter Palmer, not to the same extent, but, like, a similar maneuver to the one that Dexter Palmer does in The Dream of Perpetual Motion when he inserts a writer character named Dexter Palmer, is just to, like, make fun of herself, like, this is, you know, very much, you know, and maybe it's like a writer defense mechanism to try to not be accused of a self-aggrandizement or
well, I think what you could say is the meta, only character in the novel who's a caricature is the author herself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But like the fact that it's like, you know, I don't know if I want to say a negative caricature, but it's certainly like more like that than like a Mary Sue. Is the, you know, internet term for you know, a self-insert character who's, like, beautiful and perfect in every way.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. Just funny. But yeah, anyway, I think the vampiric qualities of this section come out also in the fact of, like, creeping COVID effects. Like, you know, I think I hadn't thought of it before, but now that you kind of point all this out, like, the idea of COVID as vampire, as something that had a tendency to suck away life force and transform in a extremely negative way, like, all of that kind of tracks, I would say.
Yeah, no, I think that definitely does. And then relating it to a ghost story, which is a different flavor of horror story.
Yeah.
After Louise tells Tookie that they're essential, you've got three sections to the end of this part before the next major part. So the last three sections within Let Me In are The Haunting of Tookie.
Right.
Flora's Mischief, talking about the ghost herself, and then Ain't No Grave.
Right.
All of them very keyed into the haunting atmosphere.
Right.
The ghost atmosphere. So that it really highlights the idea of this ghost becoming central once COVID hits, right? That seems to feed the ghost and give her more power, almost.
Right.
With Tookie's isolation in her essential status. And that's something, too, that she wrestles with this idea of being essential that Louise feels is just utterly positive. Tookie sees it more nuanced, perhaps, maybe not all positive.
That there's there's a obligation implied to being essential that, again, as someone who went through the pandemic in the restaurant setting was, like, definitely paradox, I guess, that I encountered and more or less had to struggle with every day was, like, the, like, positive nature of being essential and then the obligation of being considered essential, especially in a job that, to me, like, I was grateful to have a job and I was happy to, like, provide a positive experience for the community when the community was, like, in need of those things. At the same time, like, I work at a chocolate shop that does cafe food. Like, the word essential would not come to mind.
Sure.
And I think that, like, maybe Tookie's struggling with both of those things, like the obligation, but also, like, maybe to her, like, bookstores, like the question of if I don't know, like, are we actually essential? Is, like, what does that mean? You know, I think probably both are on her mind.
Well, and what's interesting too is she's not necessarily in the sphere of work itself afraid of COVID. The virus itself has that aspect of fear in general, but right. Work itself, the threat is fairly quickly dispelled in the last paragraph on page 190. But that's shortly after what you finished quoting there, after Louise's phone call with Tookie and when she hung up. But I want to finish that paragraph that you were reading there too, where she says, going to work meant I had to go back to a place where a ghostly hand might beat me to the light switch, or someone might kill me by touching or breathing on me. So there's the threat of the virus itself. Or worse, I might touch, shout at, talk to, and kill somebody else. So the threat of death going out from her is even worse. No, I really didn't want to adapt unless it meant staying in bed. If life had to go on, I wanted life before a ghost, before the light switch, before this virus, before the buried murder book that infected my dreams. So all of these things, and the murder book is something we have hardly touched on itself. Yes. But all of these things are united in that last sentence there. And I want to highlight the ghost itself being the feature here, that it is really the undefinable fear that is characteristic here. That yes, there's fear of the virus, certainly. That's there. And measures are taken by some in different ways to stem that fear. It still exists. But there's also this undefinable fear. And that's what's really lurking behind all of this. COVID itself, the virus itself, is maybe just one aspect, one form of the horror story, if you will. So, like, that's why I think this fits into the context of a story like Let Me In, right? That you still got the ghost story, because it is just this larger horror story of the undefinable. It was H.P. Lovecraft who said the only fear is fear itself.
That, did he? Is that what he said?
No. No, he didn't. No. Thank you. No, he said fear of the unknown is the greatest fear.
Yes, that's...
And that's kind of what's going on here, is that this unknown, this unknowable, really. Yeah. And that, I think, is what's ultimately fascinating about the character of Flora, is once she becomes known, recognized, addressed, that's when... the fear is dispelled at the end.
Sure.
When she's sort of, and it is, it's even her absolution, if you will, is kind of uncertain and unclear, but mm-hmm. it's present there at the end.
It's like you mentioned in the last episode, sort of the like Buffy the Vampire Slayer analogy. Much as I kind of hate to dwell on that too much, but the difference is, like, in Buffy the... Well, okay, I'm going to assume that I have never actually watched a whole episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but knowing sort of 90s TV from that time and that kind of storytelling...
You can extrapolate.
I assume that the difference is, like, in Buffy, it's like... You hit the books, you figure out, oh, here's the thing that we didn't know before that's, like, how you slay this monster.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, it's like they hit the books and they try all their things, and one or more of them or some combination of them works, but it's never really... You don't get mm-hmm. that satisfying, like, that bow tie answer of, like, what thing it is or why it is or what... necessarily, like, you can extrapolate, right. You could, you know, if we were doing this book in over multiple class sessions in a graduate seminar, like, we'd probably have a discussion where we'd float multiple ideas of why, any number of which could be interesting. And yes, this is
yeah, like, just
assigning grad papers again.
An essay question could be, how is the ghost dispelled? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that there is no simple, straightforward, one-sentence answer for that. You've got to have, you've got to cite your sources and back it up.
Right. Before we get too far.
Because.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, because there are multiple aspects of what needs to happen for this ghost. And I like how you said unsatisfying, because it is kind of unsatisfying that you don't ultimately really know what the ghost is after, mm-hmm. If indeed there is a ghost, which is a question that I don't think the book is centrally interested in that question, but I think it is present, mm-hmm. The question of the existence of the ghost herself, because, again, Tookie, I think one other person might have some experience with the ghost, but that is unreliable in itself. And it could even be just that one person's own personal experience with the fear and trauma and everything, just as Tookie might be having this personal experience with all of these things. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, what the ghost is after. You know, you get these clear statements about the identity and the everybody wants to be an Indian sort of picture here, and Flora being one of those who tries to craft an Indian identity, but then finds out through this book that kills her, the murder book, as it's so titled, that she is descended from is it a slave owner, an Indian slave owner, something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
It's a little unclear, and if I weren't to reread the entire book, if I were to reread sections, it would be that section, like going back into that history and trying to parse that out a little more. But I mean, the unparsability of it is kind of the point too.
Yeah, and it makes a point about history, and again, you know, the Pat, like, Monster of the Week TV show answer would be that, like, there was one neat, like, here's why your ancestors were racist and why you, a white people, you know, doesn't get what you want. Like, the unparsability is much more in line with how history actually works and historical records actually work. Like, you know, there are just things that it's just so easy to lose stuff in history, including in quite recent history.
Well, and that's even fascinating, even thinking of this as a COVID book, mm-hmm. that seems central, mm-hmm. this current history that is being lived is, as it's being lived, becoming unparsable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I was going to change the subject, so if you had any other thoughts on
that. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's interesting to me, too, with this unparsability, as we've coined this term now, that Flora, who ostensibly is an angry ghost because she doesn't get to be an Indian, through no fault of anyone in the living world or the recently dead world, is choosing to haunt and take out her anger on this one Indian friend she has.
Right.
I mean, that might add to it has the potential to add to a persecution complex that Tookie might have. Mm-hmm. You never fully get that. There's certainly some of that in Tookie, that she feels persecuted. I don't even like saying it that way, because, like, you get aspects of, is it the woman in the blue car or whatever, that's just, like, one of the most absurdly hilarious, painful parts.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, like, Tookie is persecuted. Like, whether it's in terms of the carceral system that I mentioned towards the end of the last episode, or, the woman in the blue car literally, I would argue, literally persecuting her.
Sure.
Whether she knows she's doing it or not, or whatever, like, you could argue about intentionality, maybe, but, like, still, like, the effect is the same.
Right. And then on top of it, she's being persecuted by this ghost.
By this ghost, yes.
Right? And I think that the ghost becomes a crux there, too. And I talked about whether the ghost exists or not. And this becomes, I think, a through line or a hinge, perhaps, that, you know, if the ghost exists, she's another external persecutor. If she doesn't exist, she's another internal persecutor. And that, like, Tookie experiences both. Mm-hmm. She's got both. And ultimately, we talked about Tookie's character arc. In the last episode, too. I think part of her character arc is learning to accept that she can't change the external persecutors directly. She can find the community within which she has more support than persecution, mm-hmm. but she can, to an extent, overcome her internal persecutors. Mm-hmm. And the ghost becomes kind of a crossover there, where if she can overcome her internal persecutors, there is hope, there's a light for dealing with external persecutors as well, whether it becomes, you know, fixing them, changing them, silencing them, removing them. Some of that sounds more sinister than I mean it.
Sure.
is possible.
Yeah. That, I mean, a lot of it, I think, to phrase it slightly differently, I think a lot of it was about healing.
Yes.
And that the idea that he, like, you asked me about Tookie's character arc last episode, and I didn't have any kind of great response, but I think, I suspect some of it is to do with not just healing. I think there's definitely healing would be one valid answer to that, but I think even before healing, like, accepting the possibility of healing almost seems something that she has to learn.
Yes.
And again, you know, it's, we talked last time about sort of this novel having a somewhat fractal nature, and I think that Tookie ends up having to learn the lesson that healing is possible multiple times. Even starting with is it Pollux who's her man?
Yep.
You know, starting with sort of a re-meeting him in the sporting goods store after she gets out of prison, and you know, the passage I read last episode about holding a baby, like, she has to, like, learn and relearn this lesson multiple times. And, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe the more I think about this, the more I think that, like, possibility is, like, even the acceptance of possibility is a big theme, and maybe a big theme of Tookie's character arc specifically, that may be part of what that recurring just dictionary sentence is about. The door is open, go. Like, an open door is sort of it's extremely obvious in the most artistic way possible as far as metaphors for possibility. You know, even the last few sentences of this book: ghosts bring elegies and epitaphs, but also signs and wonders. You know, elegies and epitaphs being related to what you said about death kind of surrounding Tookie, but signs and wonders being a, you know, surprisingly biblical phrase for the possibility of a future and of a healing in the future. What comes next? I want to know. And again, like, that pair of clauses seems like a hard-won pair of clauses for Tookie. Like, being able to ask the question, what comes next, and even being able to admit or decide that she wants to know. And then drags the dictionary to her side. I need a word, a sentence, the door is open, go. Like, it's all, now that I'm, like, the way I'm thinking about it, it just seems like it's all very much to do with the acceptance, the opening of possibilities, and then mm-hmm. both maybe previous and subsequent to that, the acceptance of possibility, the existence of possibility.
Yeah. Right, rather than being locked into a sentence,
yeah.
being freed by a sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
Is kind of the transition that Tookie goes through.
Yeah.
I do
yeah. want to, before I forget again,
yeah.
and before we get too far away from the section Let Me In, just want to point out a thought I had while we were talking about that.
Yeah.
section, which is just that again, a worse writer and a writer who was actually guilty of kind of the slapdash thing that we posited and then I think thoroughly rejected the possibility that Louise Erdrich was guilty of, the much worse theoretical writer who would actually do that, I think what they would do is use the section Let Me In and the COVID stuff to introduce the ghost.
Oh, sure.
And I had been trying to remember as I was paging through that section, because, you know, you get all this COVID stuff, and then you get the section called The Haunting of Tookie. I was like, wait, is this where the ghost comes in? And no, of course it's not, because... and I say this largely in, like, support of some of your rhetorical questions, regarding, like, what does the ghost, what does COVID change or show about Tookie that the ghost doesn't already change or show?
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm deeply paraphrasing something you said to me, like, not that long ago in Gregorian calendar time. but still, yeah, like, just, Yeah, I don't know. I guess that was kind of it. Just like the fact, because I paged back through to make sure, and like the ghost is already well and truly present in the text and in Tookie's experience before this. And again, I think that reflects some of even just the real life stuff I've been talking about like COVID acting, and you said it too. You introduced the word amplifier, like. COVID acting as not an introduction of something new, but as an amplifier of, or a condenser almost, of stuff that was already going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and the ghost is introduced already pretty much on page 32.
Oh, is it that early?
Of the novel. It is very, very early. This is after... After she re-met Pollux, after she left her incarceration.
Oh, sure.
And then she goes in, starts working at a bookstore, and then the last sentence of this section, well, two sentences. In November 2019, death took one of my most annoying customers, but she did not disappear. And then you get into Story of a Woman, and it's the first section there is November 2019. 5 days after Flora died, she was still coming to the bookstore. So there, I mean, you've got the ghost already introduced there. You get a little more backstory of Flora, which is an interesting bit on its own.
Yeah.
You get insight into Tookie's character, but you also see Flora died on All Souls Day. I want to come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's on page 36. On page 37, there's a paragraph, a one-sentence paragraph, where it's talking about a picture, a photograph, and it's the first full paragraph on page 37, just the one sentence. The woman in the picture looked Indian-esque, or she might have just been in a bad mood.
Right.
There's so much going on in just that sentence
right.
That talks about Tookie's self-image, that, the idea of being Indian... is also ugly to Tookie, right? That, like, she's just in a bad mood. She just looks like she's in a bad mood can be enough to make a person in this old photograph look Indian. I mean, that's that speaks so much to what Tookie feels about her own identity, and is in such sharp contrast to what we discover about Flora's desire for her self-identity, mm-hmm. that Tookie feels a kind of externalized in her own skin as a Native American, where Flora wants that identity mm-hmm. for some reason. It's not fully clear. You know, the reason maybe doesn't matter. But that Flora desires to be part of that community, mm-hmm. Of the Indian community. And Tookie feels kind of whatever about it.
Right.
and maybe not even just whatever, but even self-deprecating.
Right, yeah.
And that's, I think that's something that's just so fascinating that's going on in the character of Tookie there. As she looks at this picture, and that really sets up kind of the arc of Flora herself, where she's talking about her great grandma who was an Indian, which we find out isn't true, as we get to the sentence that killed her
right.
later on. But the idea that she died on All Souls Day, November 2nd, is intriguing. And Ethan, I want to know, is there, in your opinion, or in your reading of this book, is there more going on to the date of All Souls Day than the convenience of a ghost story?
I don't know if this is a leading question, and if it is, I don't know exactly where it's supposed to be leading me. That said, as you mentioned that, I was inspired to page all the way, because you had mentioned page 36, I was inspired to page all the way to page 363, mm-hmm. near the end of the book, which is the beginning of a section called Souls and Saints. The first subsection is just called Dark of the Year, and it just says, October 31st, Halloween, the day that demons roam. November 1st, All Saints, the day the saints triumph. November 2nd, All Souls, the day for souls in purgatory. November 3rd, Election Day, all and none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that there probably is some room to explore the like, Election Day connection, and the essentially contest of whether to reelect a president that you know, some people would, including, I have to guess, someone like Tookie would characterize as a demon if any of these things that.
Well, don't they call him Orangey?
Yeah, they do call him Orangey.
In the text of the book, so, I mean, like, it's in the text.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. And, you know, some people would call him a saint. There's probably a purgatory connection there. Like, you know, there's plenty of room there, and especially if we're going with, like, the vampiric elements and as well as the haunting, like, there's a lot there. But you didn't ask me about November 3rd, you asked me about November 2nd, All Souls Day, the day for souls in purgatory. And I mean, I don't know, again, it's a little bit fractal to me, like, there's a lot of places this could go. I think that the indigenous American tribes and their interaction with Christianity has a lot to do with Catholicism, both in ways that Catholicism has, like, acted kind of syncretistically to, you know, a lot of indigenous tribes have, from their perspective, taken elements of Catholicism into their practice from Catholicism's perspective probably would say, like, taken elements of, like, they've taken elements of indigenous tribes and incorporated it into Catholicism. So, like, you know, if the purgatory thing could have to do with some of those connections, you could certainly, like, argue that, like, this shop is Flora's purgatory, and I mean, the connection between, like, purgatory and ghosts, you know, like, often there's kind of that connection, even going back to Hamlet, like, Hamlet's father's ghost, also named Hamlet, does, make reference essentially to being in purgatory until sort of, it's like a combination of Catholicism and the, like, unfinished business, of like ghost lore, where it's like he's more or less doomed to roam in purgatory until someone finishes his business, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yep. Right.
So I don't know if any of that was, like, what your connection with All Souls Day was, but that was, like, the most textually based set of connections I could come up with off the dome.
That you've hit on a lot of really good points, and really it wasn't a fully leading question, but a little bit, and I'm glad you found exactly the page I was thinking of, because if I were to reverse engineer this book, it would be basically from this page, that I think tying All Souls Day to Election Day. I think just seeing, like, okay, look, we've got All Souls Day followed immediately by Election Day. Oh, wait, All Souls Day comes right after All Saints Day, which comes right after Halloween. Look at this progression of basically Dante, his Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso, not exactly in that order, but then culminating finally in Election Day. Can we fill that with significance? reverse engineering from there, I think, is where we can get this ghost story book. So in terms of the ghost herself, All Souls Day functions so well because it is the purgatory idea, and, like, from purgatory, that's where the ghosts roam is the idea, and the unfinished business is all tied up with purgatory, like, very precisely, because, like, purgatory is where you go to finish your business,
right?
And so, like, then that just bleeds over into the material world, where you've got unfinished business here to finish up because you're a ghost. And anyway, so, like, it fits so well. But then, like, having as the backdrop the demons and the saints, and then leading finally to Election Day, so it all becomes politicized. So the ghost becomes a political actor, and I mean that in the broadest sense of political. That, like, you've got Election Day, which is very precisely and narrowly political, but then you take it in a broader sense of political, and you're dealing with the material world, you're dealing with policy, you're dealing with civilization, you're dealing with people interacting with people. And creating community, finding community, and building their identity within community. That's what I mean by this whole idea of political. And I think that's all at the core of this book, is where your political broad sense identity is where your community is, and who your community is, who your essential community is. And the ghost becomes part of that, that every community is itself haunted by ghosts. And who are those ghosts? Identifying those ghosts, dealing with those ghosts, even if it's not, you know, we talk about the solution to the ghost, even if it's not a clear solution to the ghost, just being able to address it and deal with it is what a community needs to do. And I think if there's a message or a moral in this book that I would get shot over describing is... the idea that you just, as a community, it's important to look at, identify, and deal with the ghosts that are haunting you.
Yeah, and I think that, like, to me that connects with an allusion you made, at least, to this, the ghost story element of this book kind of subverting a lot of the tropes, and, that's even pointed up in a passage that I will not be able to find if I look for it. But there's a passage where they kind of almost, like, hang a lampshade on that idea, in the sense that, like, they I don't remember if it's Tookie's narration or if it's in conversation, but at one point it's basically said that, like, this is actually kind of the correct order in terms of, like, a lot of horror made by white people, like, has, you know, there's, like, the cliche of, like, the Indian burial mound or the Indian graveyard or whatever that causes the ghosts, and that essentially, like, that white guilt, like, becomes the haunting, but that really it's, like, white people that are haunting this land that these indigenous tribes have been on for generations. And, you know, a lot of, like, the knee-jerk reaction that a lot of white people have when they're very rarely confronted with this sort of thing is, you know, well, it's too late now, like, whatever. And I think a theme I've been noticing in a lot of work, especially by like, Native American authors, but also, like, Black authors, and, you know, I've been noticing it more so in more recent works. It's probably always been there, and it's just more obvious to me more recently, but is this idea of, like, the reckoning with history. Like, I actually read my first book of 2024. I read a book that is mentioned, that's called out specifically in the dialogue of this book, as well as being mentioned in the back section. A book called Almanac of the Dead by Leslie Marmon Silko.
Nice.
And it's, I won't, like, if I start talking about that, this will be the Almanac of the Dead podcast, and that's not what this is, but suffice it to say that, like, a major theme and a very relevant theme of that book, which was written in the early, or published even in the early 90s, is the fact that, like, white folks in the Americas especially are afraid of reckoning with their history, and that, like, no progress will be made until we, like, fully reckon with the history of, you know, injustice and genocide and slavery and all of that stuff that, like, you know, we acknowledge it, but it's, like, in half measures. And I think that, like, part of what the haunting is, that you describe in various communities, if there is such a thing as the white community, which is a loaded idea to begin with, but, like, we have some real we have a lot of real urgent ghosts to deal with, and generationally we continue to just do everything we can to avoid dealing with them. And, you know, I don't think it's Louise Erdrich's job to tell white folks, like, what to do or how to fix it or how to be better or anything like that. But I think if there's a takeaway for me as, like, a white man, that's the big one, that I keep coming back to.
That's great. In the twilight hours of this podcast episode here, you brought up the last bit of the book here, and I do want to touch on that, because we've got the section, the totally biased list of Tookie's favorite books,
which I love,
and
I love,
I am so happy that this exists.
Yes, I just wanted to say that, like, one of the things I love about this is the fact that it's so just, like, wide-ranging. Like, it refuses to be defined by any given, like, sort of artificially defined genre or community or, you know, it's like, I mean, it would be perfectly understandable if this section were all indigenous authors or something like that, and, like, the fact that it's the fact that it's,
like, that'd be fine.
That would be fine and valid and understandable, but, like, the fact that it's not just feels so much, like, more, like, wide-ranging as well as, like, graceful.
In the theme of, you know, authors avoiding the obvious,
yeah.
that in a meta way, we ourselves have not really talked about the theme of books in this book, which we could probably spend an hour on. But it speaks to the fact that you're bringing up that it is not just Indigenous authors really speaks to the essential nature of books. And that transcends any given community, that if this community that Tookie belongs to of the people in the bookstore and an Indigenous community itself, can have benefit from books outside of their own personal authorship, any community can benefit from books outside of their own authorship, right? I mean, that's I think what it's getting at. That's I think the point in general.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that, like, and I don't want to make too big a deal of it, but, like, there's even, like, at least one entry on this list by Joseph Conrad, and, like, a lot of, like, Black and Indigenous scholars consider Conrad's Heart of Darkness to be, like, one of the most racist novels ever written.
Sure.
And that's, you know, like, we could have 2 to 4 episodes even debating that question or turning around.
Oh, yeah.
But, again, it's just, like, even the inclusion of an author like that just, like, implies that, like, it feels, and this is obviously just influenced by all of the recent discussion we've had specifically, but, like, it feels connected to Tookie's moment with the baby of, like, maybe not everyone is defined by their worst moment, and, like, maybe someone like Joseph Conrad still has something to contribute in other ways, like, when he's not addressing race or whatever. Like, yeah, again, there's, like, an inclusiveness and a graciousness to it.
And seeing value just in books in general, I love it. I'll say one of the first things I noticed was that in this whole comprehensive multi-page list, there are 2 books that we've already covered on the podcast and one that we're about to cover on the podcast. So, and, you know, that was nice and validating for me.
I feel good about that.
right.
So I assume you're referencing, we have The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. We have Beloved,
Wide Sargasso Sea by Gene Reese.
Toni Morrison, that we're going to cover starting next episode. And yeah, Wide Sargasso Sea by Gene Reese. Yeah, I was trying to scan quickly to see if there were any other podcast books.
I don't believe there are. I've gone through, and, like, it'd be great if we had unlimited time, unlimited airtime, and all of that. This list could be a podcast.
Absolutely.
And, you know, maybe if I'm struggling to find inspiration for a book pick at some point, maybe I'll just turn to these pages.
I strongly suspect that you could just close your eyes and point and land on something worth going into.
I believe that wholeheartedly, that it would be worth it. Yeah, with just about anything on this whole list.
That said, I would really love to do, like, a speed run, and I'm not trying to take your episode over, but, like, just do a speed run.
No, please.
Books that we do, like, have read or are familiar with or whatever.
Oh, please. Yeah. You've probably read plenty more than I have. Aside from the 3 podcast books that we've already referenced, 2 already done, 1 about to be done. Looking through this quickly, I think there is only 1 other that I have read, and that is The Buried Giant by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Okay. I have read, just again glancing through it, I've read a solid handful of these. And in interest of full disclosure, I did take in grad school 2 different classes that were essentially contemporary Native American literature. They weren't all called that, but, like, That's what it amounted to. So, like, living or recent Native American authors. And, you know, those classes not only exposed me to several works, but, like, prompted me to seek out others. Reading through this list, just quick under indigenous or oh sorry under short perfect novels, I have definitely read Winter in the Blood by James Welch, who's an indigenous author. I've read Waiting for the Barbarians by J.M. Coetzee, who is a South African author. Very close to the top of my list under Sailboat Table is A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. Let's see. I mean, there are, as I'm scanning this, there are a bunch of books that I'm like, why haven't I read that already? I have read Ceremony, also by Leslie Marmon Silko, who wrote, Almanac of the Dead. Ceremony is also a really great book. It's fairly widely like studied in college classes and stuff, but it's honestly a stunning book that I have thought about taking to this podcast. Under Books for Banned Love, I have read All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy.
Nice.
Under
I've seen Legends of the Fall. Does that count?
is it based on the same book?
I honestly have no idea.
Because okay. I was gonna
it could be.
I was gonna like base whether it counts on that. I have under Indigenous Lives, I have read a different book by Joy Harjo, Not Crazy Brave, that's
okay.
listed here. I don't remember the one I did read, so I don't know if I get credit for that. Under Indigenous Poetry, we have a book by Hyde E. Erdrich, Hyde being the first name, E being the middle initial, who is Louise Erdrich's sister.
Yes.
And I read one...
There was another Erdrich yes. Night Train in the Sailboat Table. I don't know if that's related.
Erdrich or Liza Erdrich. Yeah, I believe she is...
Liza. It might be Liza.
Also Louise Erdrich's sister.
Okay.
I skipped over that because I wasn't positive about it, and I haven't read her, so...
That's
but funny. I have read some poetry by Hyde Erdrich that's very good and worth seeking out.
Nice.
I mean to read... I've read other stuff by Kazuo Ishiguro. I haven't read The Buried Giant. Housemaid of Dawn I did read in Native American Lit. I don't remember much about it. I probably should read it again. I have read Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness. So this was all under Sublime Books.
Sublime Books, yeah.
Under Tookie's Pandemic Reading, I did read The Heart Song of Charging Elk in grad school, which is a really magnificent example of, like, really meticulous and detailed historical fiction. It's about, a Native American man who ends up in France somehow in like the 19th century. I can't.
Nice.
I may be confusing it with another book, but I believe he gets hired to be part of Buffalo Bill Cody's like Wild West show, and then somehow ends up stranded in France. It's a really interesting book.
That sounds interesting.
One I haven't read, but I love the shout out here. Under Tookie's Pandemic Reading, we have the Aubrey Maturin novels by Patrick O'Brien, which the first novel in that series is called Master and Commander and was made into a Russell Crowe movie about 20 years ago. I very specifically love the shout out to that because the Aubrey Maturin novels were also some of my wife's pandemic reading, like one of the series that she just kind of like went into to escape the
See that's one of those sets of books that like if I were to ever own them, I would want the set that goes together and paints the mural picture when you've got them all together. You know?
Absolutely.
Like, I need to make sure they're all exactly the same edition so that they fit that perfectly. Right.
Absolutely. And that's all I've got on this. Like, again, a lot more books that I wish I had read already and intend to read, especially around incarceration, as well as, you know, a lot of just, like, literature that I haven't gotten to yet that I know I would like to.
Yes. This has joined a set of books that I've got, and I don't remember the titles or even the authors of all of them, but, like, they're books about books. Mm-hmm. And this is the only fiction among them where they have lists of suggested reading, you know, and this is part of it. And what I want to do with all of those is read all of their suggested reading, and hit it all and make sure I've crossed it all off. So, I'm not allowed to die, until I've read them all. And if I die before I've read them all, then I'm going to be a ghost and I will knock these books off the shelf until I've read them.
Yeah. I have the exact same plan. I remember, a couple years ago, there's these, like, series of coffee table books that are, like, 1001 blank you must consume before you die. So there's, like, 1001 films you must see. And I paged all the way through 1001 books you must read before you die, and I had only read, like, 270 of them. Which I was like...
Oh, no.
Well, I was like, okay, that means that I'm only 200, like, 27% of the way through my life. Like, I physically cannot die until I've read these other, you know, 830 books or whatever that math masks do.
So if that serves as the oracle of what serves for you to die, you in true Greek tragic hero fashion are going to avoid reading ever again.
Well, I'm gonna read 1,000 of the books, and I'm gonna pick out the, like, least interesting one or the most offensive one or to my sensibilities or whatever it is, and I'm gonna not read that one. But in true Greek tragic hero fashion, somehow me trying not to read that one will force me into reading it. Like, I don't know what it will be, but, like, someone I care about will get shot if I don't do a book report on this one. It's like some, you know, nonsense like that. And then I'll read it, I'll do my book report, and then I'll die. So, like, yeah.
Perfect. All right. So now that I've got my plot laid out before me, for what I'm going to do to Ethan in the future, this is where I think we need to end this episode, Ethan.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better place to than death. We are on to our ratings now. No one has lost so far, so no punishments need to be meted out. But Ethan, would you take this book and rate it on a scale of buy, borrow, forget about it?
Buy twice, which is what I did.
You it's true. You did.
Because I bought this book, new in a bookstore. I read it and then I brought it to Michael to read for this podcast, and then I had to buy it again so I would have one to refer. I meant to reread it and I didn't, but at least I had it to refer to on this episode. So buy twice is my rating.
Buy twice. Very good. Well, I'm also going to say buy it. I didn't, but I'm going to tell other people to. Honestly, this is a book to come back to. It is deceptively simple, I think. Really, I think very important for the historical moment that we are in, as well as having plenty to say about truth beyond the historic moment. And I think this is a valuable book. If for no other reason, just for that last section of Tookie's unbiased list of favorite books, I mean, grab that. But otherwise, the book itself, I think it has a lot to say about ghost stories and what they do to serve us now, amongst many, many other things. So yes, buy it. That's what I have to say.
Excellent.
We're not going to rate the scotch, the Jura 12, right now, but we will rate the pairing. How does Jura 12 pair with The Sentence by Louise Erdrich, Ethan?
I'm going to say perfect match, specifically because something, like, and I'm not going to fully spoil my scotch review, but, like, I was actually picking up a lot of what I can only describe as, like, pine tree notes. Like, a lot of... If I envision, like, the smell of pine needles and pine, like, bark and pine sap, it was, like, if you translate that into a taste, like, that's what a lot of elements of the scotch felt like to me. And... that just felt very appropriate for sort of a lot of the Minnesota and the, you know, the sort of upper Midwest, like, when I think of the upper Midwest and Minnesota in general, maybe not the Twin Cities specifically, but, like, especially if you get farther north of the Twin Cities, like, a lot of the imagery to me is, like, pine tree based. So just based on, like, that connection, I'm going to rate it a perfect match.
I'm very mad at you because I'm also saying a perfect match. And what, not for the exact same reasons, but what I, the term that was coming to mind for me that connects both the book and the scotch is deceptively chill.
Sure.
They're both deceptively chill. That you can just chill and read this book, and you can just chill and read this scotch. If you examine either one with more detail, you will find a lot more intense complexity, which, if you delve far enough, you will reach a point where it again becomes quite chill. That's why I think they're a perfect match for one another.
I love that. I love that very much.
Thank you. So, Ethan, next time we are going to be discussing the book Beloved by Toni Morrison, which is, we should say, one of Tookie's favorite books. We brought that up as we were going through. Not planned.
But love it.
Yes, another ghost story coming up, because it is on the ghost managing list of Tookies. Beloved by Toni Morrison will be our next set of episodes. So, gentle listener, read along with us, share your thoughts in the contact section of tapestryradio.org, and check out the other shows on the Tapestry Radio Network, like Intermission, the Backstage Drama Podcast, Pokemon Rollout, the Pokemon Tabletop United Actual Play RPG Podcast, Us Play Fiasco, the Actual Play Fiasco RPG Improv Podcast, Vampires and Mermaids, the Vampire and Mermaid History and Thematic Discussion Podcast, and the other shows that are on the network. I think I've hit all the big ones. Did I miss anything?
Did you say
anything else you want to promote?
Did you say Vampires and Mermaids? You probably just said it.
Yes, I did.
Then no.
All right, we're covered. Check it out. Go to tapestryradio.org, find all our shows, look at them all, and enjoy them. And until next time, gentle listener, just remember, it's our party, and we'll cry if we die before we read our TBR list. Bye.
Bye.
Obscurantism and obfuscation.
Orally observed, gentle listener.
Gentle listener.
Gentle listener.
Gentle listener.
Obviated objects of oblivion.
Obambulating about.
Offered unto you.
Offered unto you.
Offered unto you.
In the Tapestry Radio Network.
TapestryRadio.org.
From our fancy to yours.